Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae on News Talk.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be talking about hallucinations and specifically command hallucinations, where a voice tells you to do something. Why do we obey it? And what happens if we don't? If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of those comments at the end of the podcast. First, as always, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Dr. John Regan, Research Fellow in the Department of Theoretical Physics at Maynooth University. I warn you both, I've had a lot of coffee. So, Ruth, our first story has to do with breath tests. And I'm really surprised this isn't something that's been around for a long time. I would have thought this would have been an obvious one.
Yeah, you know, I had that same thought. I kind of had to go and search, do we not already have something like this? But I guess the sort of the story starts when you go into hospital in pain, maybe with a fever, and a lot of clinicians will look at you and say, we better get you on an antibiotic just in case.
Yeah.
But then they take a sample and they send it away to a lab. And really our gold standard testing for whether you have a bacterial infection is to grow a bacteria in culture, which really takes at least overnight, if not a bit longer. Mm-hmm. So they can't wait for that to make a clinical decision. So they give you a broad spectrum antibiotic. And we all know that giving out broad spectrum antibiotics when you don't necessarily need them isn't a great outcome for everybody.
So preemptive.
Exactly. So how do we get in with quicker tests? And there are some quicker tests out there. So if you remember, like during COVID, that the antigen test, that kind of lateral flow test, there are some of them that have been sort of trialed and are close to market, but for bacteria,
obviously.
But they're quick, but they're not necessarily as accurate, or they might be very specific to one type of bug.
Yeah.
And of course, bugs change, so there are some issues with those. So really, these researchers in the University of California and St. Jude's Hospital were trying to see, could you combine that really good specificity with speed?
Mm.
And they were inspired by a test that's done for Helicobacter pylori, which is the bug that's associated with giving you stomach ulcers, and in that test, they essentially give people a special drink, which the substance is metabolized only by Helicobacter pylori, and it produces a metabolite, a type of carbon that then goes into your bloodstream, and they can pick it up in your breath.
Huh.
And so that was what inspired them. But what they did is they sort of said, can we pick up bacteria maybe in your bone marrow or embedded in anywhere in your body by picking up metabolites from those bacteria? So what they did was their idea was to give a sugar solution, but not just regular sugar, because all our gut bacteria would love to get their hands on that, but mannitol, which is a sugar that our own bacteria in our body don't eat. And of course, they put it into the blood so it's isolated from our gut bacteria so they don't get their hands on it either.
Right.
And they modified the carbon in the mannitol. So instead of carbon 12, which is the normal carbon, they put a heavier carbon, carbon 13, which doesn't do any harm. But as it's metabolized, it can be picked up in the breath. Coming out. And what they found was, and they can pick that up using a very simple spectroscopy technique, a benchtop, fairly cheap piece of kit that they can use.
Yeah.
And what they found was that within 10 minutes, they could detect a bacterial infection.
Injection 10 minutes later, they could...
out metabolite of carbon 13 in the breath from the mannitol being metabolized by the bacteria. And they could do this for E. coli, they could do this for Pseudomonas, so they could do this for a wide range of different bacteria. And they actually pushed it even further, because then if they administered an antibiotic, they could see the level of carbon 13 in the breath going down.
Wow.
So you could actually see straight away if you were using the right antibiotic. So rather than, again, using a broad spectrum, you could go into the more specific antibiotic, give it 10, 20 minutes, half an hour, see if it looks like it's working, and then go in with something else if you needed to. So, I mean, the researchers, if you read the quotes from them, they're really excited about this.
Yeah.
Because it is actually, you know, when you read it first, you go, this seems like something we should already have. But actually, the more you read about what they've done and kind of where the inspiration came from, it's very clever.
Yeah.
And you can really see the potential for this to move quite quickly into practice, because, I mean, a mannitol drip, a glucose drip, I mean, that exists in a hospital already. You know, breathing tests using a spectroscopy, you know, easy, it's there already.
So, I mean, turnaround times, very quick.
Because
you don't need, you could do a battery of these things, identify the exact bacteria, see it's working, then say, that's useful, solved, you know, without having to wonder, you know, is it sepsis? Is it something
else? And that's the big issue, you know, like avoiding sepsis without taking that really precautionary principle of doling out loads of broad spectrum antibiotics, which are leading to the global issue of antimicrobial resistance.
Which isn't getting any better either.
It's not getting any better. So really great science.
Fantastic. Our second story, John, It sounded like a big story to me, but then I'm a layperson who doesn't know anything. What the headline said was, scientists discover heavier version of proton with an upgraded detector. So this is CERN.
Yep.
So the big loopy thing underneath Switzerland.
That's right. Like the atom smasher or the hadron smasher, at least. Yep. That's right. So, look, is it a heavy proton? Kind of. Right.
Well, just give us a what is a proton?
I'm going to go into the proton now. Yeah. So the proton is a subatomic particle. It's made up of two up quarks and a down quark. So in like kind of like years and years ago, we thought proton was really fundamental.
Lego brick you could get.
Exactly. Itself and the electron were supposed to be the building blocks of the universe, if you like. But around the 1960s, we were starting to get our particle accelerators up and running. So that was where we were smashing atoms together or protons or electrons or whatever, and we were getting a zoo of particles coming out. And it soon became apparent that actually protons were not the fundamental particle. Within each proton are what are called quarks. And this was actually theorized by a guy called Murray Gell-Mann in the 1960s. And he got the name quark, incidentally, from one of James Joyce's novels.
Oh, really?
So, but yeah, a nice Irish connection there. But so it found, and it was quarks are really the constituents. They're the basic building blocks of nature.
Okay.
And like I said, a proton has two ups and one down. What they found in CERN this week is it different subatomic particles. Like a heavy proton, that is true. It's got two charm quarks and a down quark, so it's a little bit different. You have to be careful here. It's not going to revolutionize anything. It has been predicted. It's great that they found it. So it was an upgrade to the CERN facility. It took 1 year to find it. 10 years of
searching. But this is a new particle, as far as we know. We've never seen a new particle like this. So why is that not a big deal? Because you were very unimpressed by this story. You were like, this is a
predicted.
Clickbait.
We expected to find it. We'd already found its cousin, which had two charm quarks and an up quark already. So this is the two charm quarks and a down quark. So it wasn't a big breakthrough, but it did show you that once we got a more powerful accelerator, we were able to form this particle.
But when we look at subatomic physics, at least how it was taught in school in my day, I don't imagine this changed an enormous amount, but definitely some things would have changed, right? But the protons, I'm not that old, John, look at the face you gave me, but the protons were sort of, you know, one type of thing. You know, we didn't realize there were different types of protons, right? So it surely that has some sort of significance for how we understand the world.
Yeah, and it does. It does allow us to understand the world better. There's no doubt about this. And it allows us to probe what's called the strong force. It's really, look, how nuclei and how protons really stick together. That's true. It's a huge breakthrough for that. Now, we have to bear in mind that this heavy proton, it lasts for like femtoseconds. That's a millionth of a billionth of a second. So they're very short-lived.
A millionth of a billionth of a second.
It's quicker than that.
You wouldn't want to go for coffee, would you? And then come back when they're doing that?
Definitely not. Nothing. Or walk around the garden. Nothing like that. Right? But it is important. It does allow us to really probe particle physics and the strong force, and that's important, and test our theories.
One really quick question, because it just jumped into my head. If it's that unstable, does it actually exist in a way that's meaningful in our universe? You know, like, is it an artificial, fabrication? Because you can create things that don't really have any relevance to how our universe works.
Yeah.
Is that what it is or no?
It is important. And you have to, don't think about it in terms of human time scales, though. Like the millionth of a billionth of a second is true. But what does happen within that millionth of a billionth of a second is that the little quark, the up quark, does orbit around the charm quarks. And that's important. So it has this dynamical time within that particle. So it is a real particle. It does live for a certain amount of time, does decay very quickly. And it's through that decay we actually detect it. That's how it's detected. We detect it through its decay process, not the actual particle itself.
The way you were talking about these different types of quarks, I was imagining sort of a fairy tale. It's like you could actually totally write
a
little
charm quark.
I have no idea.
Well, there's a charm and a strange quark. Okay. So there's six quarks: up, down, charm, strange, and top and bottom.
There you go. It sounds like
seven dwarves.
Yes, seven dwarves part two. Ruth, our third story has to do with a game that I used to love. We had a network manager, and every time the network manager, we would switch screens. But most of the time, when we were supposed to be helping our staff like get their computers working, we were playing Doom, and it was the most fun ever for a 21-year-old.
I'm glad you've played Doom, because I haven't. And this story is all about Doom, so maybe you can help fill in some of the blanks for
sure.
me. So you were sitting there playing Doom when you should have been helping people. So imagine that scene, but instead of you, there's a Petri dish filled with human neurons playing Doom. So that's what's happened in Australia this week. And it's research that was done by Cortical Labs in Australia. And people may have heard of them before, because a few years ago, they hit the headlines because they had a similar experiment where they had a Petri dish of neurons playing Pong, which was a two-dimensional sort of paddle game. People might have seen it on an old Atari, where you have to bounce a ball back and forward and move a paddle left and right. But Doom, as you say, is a much more complicated game.
It's kind of like Call of Duty, if anyone's seen it.
It's kind of a primitive 3D game. You're going through corridors, you have to shoot monsters, people come at you, and you're in the first-person character. So what they did here was they had about 200,000 human neurons, which they had growing on a special kind of electrical matrix, which could send electrical signals into the neurons. And they got quite a young computer programmer, actually, who didn't have a huge amount of experience in this area, to use Python coding to turn the inputs or the output signals from Doom, so the position of the players, where a monster is coming from, into code. And then they converted that code back into sort of positional information on the grid for the neurons. So the neurons were getting the input from the game. And what they found is over time, the neurons started to play the game. So the neurons are electrically active cells. So they were able to produce charged responses to the electrical inputs that they were getting. And of course, their charged responses could be converted back into an action in the game.
But usually when you play a game or you perform an action that isn't completely random, there's some sort of reward.
Exactly. And there was a reward here. So, I mean, imagine, I suppose, like, the neurons don't have eyes, they don't have arms to play. But imagine you're dropped into a dark room. And as a biological system, you're seeking kind of a steady state or, you know, less chaos. So you don't see anything, but you can walk forward and you hear more noise and chaos, or you can walk backwards and you get to kind of calm. And I mean, that's essentially what these cells were doing. So when they did something, or they shot an electrical signal that did something good in the game, they were rewarded with a sort of steady states pulsing signal that gave a sense that they, you know, that was a state that they sort of wanted.
It wasn't a negative stimulus.
Wanted is a terrible word to use in this context, but, you know, this idea that there was some sort of reward for doing
stimulus
the right
response.
Thing. A stimulus response. Exactly. So they're not very good at playing Doom, so they're worse than a novice player, but they are better than random at playing Doom. And of course, the reason why this research is so fascinating, I mean, this is you might say, why would you even do this in a world of AI where we have computers that can do all sorts of things for us so quickly? But I mean, the human brain only uses about 20 kilowatts of energy. It's about as much, you know, as we use to light a light bulb. And it's not trained. These neural systems don't have to be trained on hundreds of thousands of scenarios to be able to do this. Mm. They just have this inherent capability to respond and create this feedback, which enables learning. So this idea of kind of biological electronic merged systems is of real interest, because they're potentially very low power computer systems that could be built. But yeah, all sorts of interesting ethical questions arise as well.
Exactly. Our final story, John, has to do with quantum batteries. And this is a pretty big story.
Yeah, this was really interesting, actually. So first of all, let's think about a lithium ion battery, which is the one in your smartphone or your EV car or whatever, you know, your Walkman. So the way that works...
Are you going to attempt to explain electricity to me?
Oh,
I've been immune
right.
for 20
no,
years.
This
Good
is
luck.
Like batteries. This
and,
is batteries.
And a Walkman. Yeah, so most
yeah.
people listening.
Yeah.
I was trying to think of something I put batteries into. It's not that frequent anymore. So with a lithium ion battery, so that's a chemical battery, and what we do is we put electricity in, we change the chemical state inside that battery, move it to a higher electrical state, and then we can discharge it basically whenever we want. Well, assume it's within some time before it leaks away. And that's how a chemical battery works. And if we want more power, we need more battery, essentially. So like, for example, your EV car has a lot of batteries in it versus your smartphone.
Yeah.
And also your EV car takes, you know, overnight to charge approximately, and your mobile phone doesn't take so long, at least, yeah, you know, given the same amount of power. But with a quantum system, it's very, very different. In that sense, it can actually take advantage of some really weird quantum behavior and operate collectively. And by that, I mean that if we want to charge up the quantum battery, it'll do so not incrementally, but or not linearly, but superlinearly. So that, like, it'll basically charge up almost instantly, given a certain amount of power. And it's not like if I want more power, I need to add more battery. It scales, it's super linearly. So with more and more batteries, I just get more and more power and I charge faster. So much, much more powerful.
What? Charge faster with a larger battery?
A lot faster because it doesn't scale as basically n, the number of molecules. It charges n to some power.
Right,
not
okay.
It, n would be 1 for a chemical battery, but it could be n to the 1.5 or something like that. So it basically harnesses the collective power of the quantum and really charges very, very quickly.
So we're
that's the real power.
And we had Valeria Nicolosi talking about graphene and 2D materials on this program. She was saying she'd worked with their colleagues in Trinity on developing the sort of material that discharges and charges instantly. We're seeing some of this technology, whether it's not as 2D, coming out of China. Actually, I don't know if you saw this week, we saw cars that will charge in 10 minutes, fully charged. Incredible stuff. But this is the first quantum battery, so it's slightly different.
Yeah.
But it will have the same effect, right? Like 5 minutes or 2 minutes to charge an entire car?
Potentially, right? This is very much a proof of concept. So we're not there yet. What they were able to show, and this was the first time they were able to, this is an Australian group, so they were able to charge it up, they were able to store it, and they were able to discharge it. Nobody had ever done that before. Mm. So this was the real breakthrough. It was the full battery cycle, if you like.
Yeah.
People had charged them up before, but not actually drained current.
Right.
So this one had gone through the full cycle. Now again, unfortunately, we're back to the same, like the protons were a timescale issue. So they charged it up in femtoseconds, stored it for nanoseconds, and discharged it.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, exactly.
So like, you know, we're not there yet.
If you sneeze, you've seen the entire, thing, right?
Gone. But like, you know, the pathway is good.
Okay, very interesting. I think, you know, in 10 years' time, looking back at how we fiddle around with adapters and how we get, like I drove to the north to Letterkenny last week and finding a charger that worked, it was just so, everything was so frustrating. And the idea that you could just recharge in 10 minutes, that, you know, such amazing stuff, you know, on the horizon.
The potential with this is that it charges faster than you fill up your car with petrol. So you just plug it in, charge it up and drive away. That'll be it. Wow. Like, it's really powerful.
It's the future. Dr. John Regan and Dr. Ruth Freeman, thank you very much. Really looking forward to this piece because it's something that really fascinates me. What happens when you hear a voice that isn't there? Is it a sort of a slant on imagination? Is your biology and your brain misfiring, or is there something more complex going on? Because we don't know a lot about hallucinations. And when perception and reality start to blur and people start hearing voices that they then think are telling them to do things, what's really going on there? That's a question that's fascinated me for years. Dr. Anna Georgiadis is a lecturer in early intervention in psychosis at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience at King's College London. And she is studying this very thing. Great to have you on the program, Anna. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. We're going to be talking about hallucinations and these command hallucinations. So tell us what exactly that is as far as we know.
Absolutely. So individuals who experience psychosis, they can have kind of strange and unusual experiences, one of them being, you know, maybe hearing voices or maybe feeling suspicious. But the people that hear voices, about half of them experience something what we call command hallucinations. So voices that give them instructions or commands to do things. Now, this could be as simple as stand up, sit down. Or it could be more scary, you know, harm someone else. And this is why it's so important clinically. And as a clinical psychologist, I do see this a lot in the clinic. So I really wanted to focus on this in my research to understand it a bit more.
I mean, even for those of us who aren't suffering from psychosis, the idea that you have a voice in your brain that you sometimes talk to, that the idea that you can have a dialogue with yourself in your brain is kind of crazy to me. Like, you know, I often find myself telling me, come on, get up, you need to get up. And then I actually get up. But I then think, who was that telling me to get up? It's me. I'm telling myself to get up. It's all very strange. But when it comes to psychosis, obviously this can be very upsetting and it can be quite scary. When someone is having an auditory hallucination, do we see the auditory cortex, the part of the brain that is associated with hearing, does that fire up? Like, do they actually hear or do they think they hear a voice?
So this is a really good question and a great distinction. So whenever we're assessing someone who's not maybe entirely sure what they're going through, we want to understand, is it a voice that they're talking, like an internal thought, like, oh, I've got to pick this up from the shops and I've got to do this today? Or is it something distinct and separate from themselves? So usually the people that I see in the clinic are on the severe side, and it's something that's causing them distress, and they're actually hearing it, like how you're talking to me and hearing me right now. It's like a separate person, but they might be hearing it in their head. They might be even hearing it outside of themselves, like in the room.
Okay, so their brain is actually perceiving this voice as very much not being them.
Yes. Absolutely. It could be a male voice, a female voice. It could be muffled. It could be clear. And I think the important distinction is it feels separate from them. It doesn't feel like a thought, oh, I'm going to, this is my plan for today. This is what I'm going to do. It actually feels very separate. And that's why it can feel so distressing.
The people who suffer from these hallucinations, do they associate the voice with a specific person? Like, would they think, oh, this is Satan, or this is God, or this is a ghost or something, or is it just a voice?
That is an excellent question. And this is kind of what the psychologist loves to find out and listen to in the session. How the client interprets it is critical. Now, they can interpret it as someone from their past, say a bully from school. They can interpret it as the voice of God or devil, angels or demons. They could absolutely be, it could be a government agent. It could absolutely be anything. And part of trying to understand what's causing them distress is trying to identify what's their interpretation of who it is.
Right, because I guess if they're hearing things that they perceive to be as bad ideas, they might say, you know, this is Satan, or this is the devil telling me to do this. And there have been cases where people have claimed that in serious criminal cases, particularly in the States, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And what we've found from the literature is that when people believe it's more on the malevolent side, like bad or Satan or demons, they're more likely actually to resist the command. If they believe it's actually something of good intention, like God or angels, they're actually more likely to comply. So part of the assessment is trying to understand, how are they interpreting it? Are they willing to listen to the instruction? Because that increases risk.
For sure. And I suppose the voice could be saying the same thing, but if it's perceived as from God versus Satan, then the outcome for that person could be completely different. They both might be saying, you know, attack that person on the street. But the motivation will change dramatically depending on how they perceive that voice in their head.
That's exactly a great point, because if they think, oh, it's the voice of God, so surely it must be a good thing to do, even if it's a terrible instruction, someone on the nose, they might be more willing to kind of comply with that command. But if it's they perceive it to be like a demon or the devil, they'll be like, oh my God, this is scary. Surely it can't be a good thing. And there's more of that ability to resist. But again, it's not guaranteed. We can't just assume it's just those two outcomes. It really is individual for every single person. That's why, sort of, in a way, the devil's in the detail. We have to get their perspective on who they think it is, and are they willing to comply, and what are their worries if they don't comply?
Yeah.
And that's where another important feature that came up in the paper was this concept of appeasement. Oh, shall I partially comply, do something a little bit to please the voice just to get them off my back?
Wow.
And that is just as important clinically. And I think it's kind of underexplored in the literature. And that's what I wanted to emphasize it in my paper.
I just want to pause for a second and just ask you, because I think it's the case that, you know, only a very small number of people who have hallucinations are actually a danger to themselves or others. And I always worry when we talk about, you know, the edges of mental health, that, that, you know, it's really important to emphasize that that hallucinations are quite normal, and lots of people have them, I would imagine. You know, command hallucinations probably a little less normal, but the percentage of the people who are dangerous, or, you know, how they're often portrayed in the media is the very 1% of the 1%. Would that be correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So look, we have to put this into perspective. About 5% of the general population will have the odd voice or the odd unusual experience or sensation, but it doesn't warrant clinical attention. Mm. They will never end up in my clinic. They might hear the doorbell ring upon wakening, or they might hear the door knock upon sleeping. This is what we call a hypnopompic or a hypnagogic hallucination. Absolutely normal, absolutely common, nothing to worry about. Now, the people that I tend to see, that's usually the 1% of the population that they've experienced just way too much stress. There might be a bit of a family history of mental health difficulties, and through no fault of their own, maybe just sometimes too much stress brings about the psychosis, which is maybe hearing voices. It could be command hallucinations. But then again, not everyone is violent, but people that we have to manage, like we have to assess for risk. And if there is a worry that they could harm themselves or others, that's why services get involved, to try and protect them and the public.
Psychosis, obviously being completely separate from, you know, psychosis and psychopath have the same stem of the word, but they're very different things, of course. And a lot of these patients do get better. But what is it like dealing with people who are at probably the worst mental state they can be at? What is it like doing that day to day?
Working with individuals with psychosis? Is that the question? Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think that they're normal people that have just really experienced just way too much stress. Failing an exam, they witnessed a mugging, they saw a car accident. They're usually lovely people that have just experienced way too much stress. And then this is the brain overfiring with maybe chemicals like dopamine and other neurotransmitters. Maybe the way they're perceiving the event, if they keep then thinking psychologically, the world is absolutely dangerous all the time. And then their anxiety level is way too high. That kind of concoction and cocktail then tips them over into maybe experiencing these more unusual experiences that are out of character for them. Mm. So really, there is hope. There is, you know, people do live rich and fulfilling lives. They could have had one incident. They have their medication. They stabilize. They have psychology. It helps them. And they may never experience psychosis again.
But when you're speaking with them, surely, having realized that there is a voice inside their head that not anyone else can hear, surely that is distressing for most of them? Or do some people welcome the voice?
It's a mixed bag. Usually the people I see in the clinic are usually distressed by the voice, which led them to come to our service in the first place. But there are a small subset of people that actually say, I'm hearing the voice of angels telling me I'm beautiful, and that's a wonderful thing. I don't want it to stop. Or it makes me feel I'm not alone. So there's a kind of protective function, is what we would call it, that there's something actually really positive about it. Now, regardless of whether they see it as positive or negative, it's what they do about it that counts. Even if they say, they say I'm beautiful, but I'm still going to go and, I don't know, punch people in the street, that's problematic. Yeah. And we have to work with the behavior, regardless of their interpretation.
So we don't yet, I mean, apart from you use CBT and sometimes drug to treat psychosis, is that right? Or is there a tried and tested path to treat someone who has a psychotic episode like this?
So absolutely. So working in an early intervention service, we try and we work with people that have had their first ever episode.
Right.
And there are three treatment pathways. There's medication, which is incredibly important, and we really encourage people to take their medication as prescribed. And they usually need to take it for 1 to 2 years following from that first episode.
Wow. Just one episode means that you're recommended to have up to two years of medication.
Yes.
Wow.
Because we want to stabilize those chemicals in the brain that could have gone wonky in response to heightened stress. But medication isn't the only thing. Where I come in is the psychology aspect. They might think, in response to stress, you know, they've got the chronic anxiety, or they're perceived world is completely dangerous all the time. So we need to balance that thinking and improve coping. And also, involving families and carers to keep doing the great job that they're doing to support their loved ones. If there's less stress in the house, there's less stress for the clients, and it works both ways. So yeah, it's families, medication, individual psychology is usually the treatment pathway.
Is there a case over the years that you worked on that has really stuck with you?
I think they're all memorable in a certain way. Thankfully, I see improvement in the people that we work with, the young people that we work with as a team, get better. And then they're like, oh, I understand now that it was this stress that caused this. And then all of these bits of intervention helped. So I can't say there's one absolute particular one that stands out. They all stand out in their own way.
Yeah.
And as I said, they're all incredible people that have just experienced just a bit too much stress.
There are certain conditions and other things that can trigger psychotic episodes, right? Like diseases and even infections sometimes.
Now, so you're talking more about the organic stuff. So if someone has maybe a brain tumor, they could have maybe some visual hallucinations or if someone's starting to experience some signs of dementia with great old age, they could maybe start maybe hearing sounds or noises.
Mm.
This is different from what we see in the clinic, because we would say that's kind of secondary to something organic going on.
Right.
We wouldn't call that a true first episode psychosis.
Right. But the hallucinations that people might have with Alzheimer's, is that a very different thing to a psychotic episode that someone might have after a traumatic experience or drug use, right? Drug use can trigger psychotic episodes?
Oh, yeah. So older age, it's different. Drug use, if they're only experiencing voices when they're high on a specific substance, we still wouldn't even call that a true psychosis.
Mm.
If they take the substance, the voice starts, but then the substance is out of their system and they keep hearing the voice, then they end up coming to us.
I see.
If it's persistent, we'd say that's a drug-induced psychosis, and maybe this is continuing and it's becoming a proper psychosis.
In terms of what determines a psychotic episode, because obviously you would have hallucinations sometimes, you might have delusions and so on, you might have disturbed thoughts. Are there other things that would say to you, this is different, this is a psychotic episode, that aren't the obvious stuff?
So in terms of anything other than voices?
Or dangerous commands. Are there other things, if you hear that, you think, this might require a little bit more thought?
Yeah. So what we also see very commonly in the clinic is people with suspiciousness. So they worry that they're being monitored, followed, or the government is after them.
Right.
And this is what we call a delusion. But there are different types of delusions. You could have a delusion that there's a chip in your brain from aliens. You could have a delusion that you're the king of England and you believe that, everyone should bow down to you in the street. And that's what we call a grandiose delusion.
Mm.
There's
one person in England who has that delusion.
Yeah. Delusion, reality. We'll let the Buckingham Palace decide that.
Yeah. It's really interesting speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us. Just before we let you go, if someone is listening and if they are concerned about themselves or another person, what is the best thing they should do if they feel like they may be having a psychotic episode?
Absolutely. So if you're worried that you're starting to have experiences that are a bit unusual, a bit of out of character for yourself, do talk to your GP. Do maybe mention an early intervention service if it's the first time you've ever experienced this, because they can refer you on. So GP, think about early intervention. And just don't worry. There is hope out there. This is the most important thing. There is medication, there's psychology. People do get better. And this is absolutely normal response to too much stress.
Dr. Anna Georgiadis from King's College London, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. Time to look back at some of your comments from last week. And we were talking about dogs changing their pitch when they listen to music and why they might do that. Saoirse says, I always admire how attuned dogs seem to be to the tone of your voice. I wonder if that's connected to their ability to understand sound. I don't know. I had this conversation with my son recently. He was like, I don't think Roxy knows her own voice. He's 11. He's a smart little kid. He said, I don't think Roxy knows the name of her voice. Like, if I just say Roxy, la la la, she won't pay attention, will she, Dad? And so we tested that, and sure enough, Roxy didn't. But when, as soon as she said Roxy, the dog flipped its head up and turned around, and it was the tone of the voice that Cohen had picked up. The dog was understanding. So I think the tone is a lot. Holly says, do dogs actually perceive music as music or simply as sound patterns? That was part of what that researcher last week was trying to figure out. Because the idea, at least, and there's a bit of evo psych, so evolutionary psychology, which can, you know, if you haven't got a lot of evidence, it can be a bit of a guessing game, but you're trying to connect why would something be a certain way, but you need evidence to be able to make something solid, right? But the thoughts were that these dogs would change their pitch to appear as a bigger pack. And so that's, you know, that's why dogs might howl at music or whatever. One person says, could species-specific music, like if it was designed around dogs' hearing ranges and natural vocalizations, could that produce stronger effects in terms of the data? What I get is, if you're talking about species-specific music, are you not just talking about like dogs making vocalizations, and then it's not really music, is it? So I don't know. I think, although our dog does, I don't know if you remember, there was a dog song on Spotify. It was pretty big one year. They made a song for dogs, and it's lots of barking. And then someone saying, good girl. And the dogs apparently went nuts for it. Our dog was like a bit meh about the whole thing. She's not really that fussed about walks, to be honest. But I don't know. I think if you're actually making dog music, then it's just howling, isn't it? Or maybe I'm dismissing an entire potential genre of actual dogs singing. But look, if you want to go down that road, that's entirely up to you. It's not something we're going to do in this show. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan producing, Rory Galvin on podcast, Hugo De Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, that was pretty fast, isn't it? Stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae. Proudly supported by Research Ireland. Sunday from midday. News Talk. Conversation that counts.